This episode of The Tour Life is also brought to you by Optimize Touring. If you're interested in learning how you can bring health and wellness on tour with you, whether it's a small van tour or a huge arena tour, go to optimizetouring.com to learn more. Welcome to The Tour Life podcast from Well Better Best. I'm Janine, your host, integrative nutrition health coach and personal trainer. In the past 10 years, I've had the privilege of meeting some of the most interesting and hardworking professionals in the music industry. Whether you are a fan of live music or someone who actually puts on the shows, you'll find some great stories, advice, and encouragement to live a happier, healthier life doing what you love. Today's guest is a tour manager who has toured with artists such as Mariah Carey, Wiz Khalifa, Neil Young, Kid Cudi, Janet Jackson, and Michael Jackson, among many others. In this episode, we discuss growing up in the theater, hitting the reset button when you feel burnout coming, the value of nurturing relationships, mental health in the music industry, the touring ecosystem, the birth of Tour Management 101, and taking action during the pandemic in order to move the music industry forward. You can find her on Instagram at The Original Lioness. Here is my conversation with the awe-inspiring Adrian Biondo. Adrian, I am so excited to have you on the show. I know you have some great stories. Let's talk, yeah?
It's an honor and a pleasure to have been invited. Thank you.
Tell me where you are now, and as far as your career, how did you even decide you wanted to do anything with the music industry? And what do you think is something that you learned along the way?
Gosh, okay. The relationship to the music industry, honestly, this was coming because my parents, being New Yorkers, my mother's best friend was Cass Elliot in Greenwich Village. My parents met at David Crosby's house. And, you know, I was a child at the feet of folk legends like Bob Gibson and Fred Neil, which are names that if you go back into the archives of folk music, Bob Dylan talks about Bob Gibson. Bob Gibson was like my godfather. He was my dad's best friend. You know, so, and my mother's, ultimately the love of my mother's life, which was something that evolved until they both were old and gray, which is so interesting. So I was destined to have, my mother, when I was younger, was a genius, and she was soldering a Dynakit stereo. She built her stereo. It was a Dynakit, was a thing that you, if you were an audiophile gearhead, you could build your own stereo system, tubes and all. And this was my mom with J.B. Lansing speakers, teaching me about Thelonious Monk and the Beatles and these amazing folk artists who were also showing up with their guitars in my living room. So then, you know, at some point, my mom needed to figure out what to do with the child. She was a single mom, and there was a lot of energy. And so to my, she decided that I was going to go into theater, and that taking me down to a theater school that she had found would be the way to reel in all of the child energy, right? And definitely, you know, sort of worked with our ecology as a mom-child duo, and her love of music and my love of the arts. I had ballet shoes when I was four, you know. So that really worked out. And the day that she brought me to my first theater class was the day that changed my life and brought a mentor into my life that to this day is a person who I draw from and who has contributed so many life experiences to me, and her family is still family to me, sisters to me. I was dropped off at the Coconut Grove Children's Theater, and I was under the tutelage of a woman called Cornelia Dozier, Corky Dozier, who's now the head of the Big Orange Committee, that, you know, the orange that drops in Bayfront Park in Miami. She's the committee chair these days of the that whole, you know, that whole party and the Pitbull, you know, downtown celebration, and for years has been involved in the arts community. And this has been 45 years. So I got dropped into the lap of genius, luckily, and I was able to study, and I started learning stagecraft. I knew about parkhands and speed shots from a professional standpoint. I was learning how to mark my blocking in the columns of our scripts, because she was preparing us for professionalism from the get-go. And when your class was on stage, for those who were on stage, you were doing your work in your acting craft. But for those who were not in Company A, Company B was producing, running the lights, changing the gels, monitoring the script, calling the cues. You were becoming an, you know, so I flipped my first house at 14 at the Gusman Theater, which is now the Olympia Theater, which is a major theater in Miami. So all of this priceless stagecraft education. And I can tell you the day that my mom dropped me off at the stage door to what was the Gusman Theater. And I walked in the door and the cool air hit me, and you're right at the stage, and the first thing you see are the pulleys from the cables of the wings. And then you look up and the ceiling is so high and the park hands are there. And then you know, I'm nine, and I look out and the seats. And then you look and you know, some of these old majestic theaters around this country are just so gorgeous. And the Gusman Center had twinkling lights in the ceiling. And it was the illusion that you were attending an event in the courtyard of some medieval time. And so the ceiling was done up dark blue with twinkling lights. And this was my first foray into such a beautiful place to work in as a professional at 9 little years old. And this was the beginning of each year we did a thing called Performathon, where children were bused in from schools on field trips to be a part of an experience that was children producing theater for children. And so what else was I ever going to do? And everything else was really a twisting, winding. And then there was a time when I fully, you know, switched into the music business. I was still directing children's theater as a grown-up. You know, I stayed with Corky as a grown-up, and once I was 17 and no longer able to be in class, then I went and was her assistant director, and she allowed me to teach, and I stayed with her until I was 25 and too busy touring and, you know, doing actual music business professional. You know, I was gone so much that I couldn't be consistent for her anymore, but I did direct. And she did allow me to receive an Ambassador of the Awards of the Arts Award from Miami-Dade County in 1992. After when we created and directed a post Hurricane Andrew, we had our kids that were affected by the storm from South Miami turn their feelings into words and music, and it became a show that we produced, and then we took it to the World Hurricane Conference and produced it for, you know, the bureaucracy of hurricane discussions at that time. So she really allowed me, and she also allowed me to work on arts, on crime prevention through arts intervention programs in the inner cities. So throughout the course, she instilled some of those values of watching your neighbor, and you know, we tackled subject matter. She formed a repertory company, and which I was in for 5 years, called the Create Company. And we did a show called The Me Nobody Knows, which was a Broadway play from the early 70s that was about racism and inequality and drugs and guns and violence and things that kids assimilate. And it was, we took those shows into, we used those shows as a form of communication. She took us into juvenile detention center to perform for those kids and to do Q&As with them. And she taught us about conflict resolution and how to, you know, do these crime prevention through arts intervention. If you take a kid off the street and you give them an interest in music and art and dance, they're going to spend their time with you, maybe not wilding out, you know? And so it was really a time for where I, those were the things that I built my passion and value system and belief system, you know, and I became an indentured servant to the arts at that time.
How did that affect the way that you approached touring when you started doing that? You had been in the arts for so long and it was such a huge part of your life. I feel that there had to have been a deeper connection in your life when you did it.
100%. And one of the things that I understood, I understood what it meant to be in a company, the company, and company A, company B, even have two companies within our, you know, our theatrical company, and what it was like to be on stage and have your colleagues in the wings calling the cues, and then also then be able to go off and switch that role and be the company that is producing, right? So you're not only the talent, but then you have the opportunity to be the crew. And I got all of that practical application of that, the flip off. I experienced that firsthand before I was 15 years old. So when I got into touring, I understood the relationship, the importance of the relationship between the crew and the talent. I understood the deep appreciation for the technical crew and everything that goes into mounting a production. I love it, by the way. I love it. I geek out for it. If a truss moves, I'm on the floor. It's amazing. I just, you know, I've been geeking out about production since I was a kid, staring up into the lights going, wow, that is the coolest thing, you know. And when I learned that you could make thunder sounds by shaking a big sheet of aluminum and then make the lights flash, I was done. You know,
no, I mean, I don't know when I found that out. It must have been like in a movie or something. But yeah, when you see kind of like how the magic is made.
Yeah. And I always, you know, I went to my first concert. My first large concert was the Bee Gees and the Pointer Sisters at the Miami Baseball Stadium. And I just remember staring up at you know, the rigging in the stage and the people, and what I was so fascinated with everything. Again, I had already understood on a little tiny theater scale, and even our teaching theater, we still had lights and a board and things that had to happen, you know? So I was just mesmerized. The bigger the show, the, you know, I just love what we do so much. And so how it transferred was I understood the relationship between how to move a company, how to organize, you know, the different departments, because I understood about the lighting department and the wardrobe department and the audio department. And these are things that I learned as a child. So when I say that I was able to take all of those skills with me, you know, it definitely was so, I was so passionate about it. I did it for so long. It always just seemed like second nature. And the organizational, you know, and company management part of my skill set was learned as in that very early time, you know, just understanding that a company is a nucleus and you have to try to make it seem that way. Rock and roll can be a whole different story, but you know, if you come in with those bases, then and then prepare to be fluid like the water, you know, best laid plans my eye. you know.
So it seems like the experience that you had since you were little, it set you up to be able to really manage that aspect of the industry. But what about the things you weren't prepared for?
The skill that you have to have when the unknown flies at you, and as in your everyday life, the best laid plans, Murphy's Law. We have a cliche every third second for, you know, what happens when life interrupts what you're really doing. And I think the important thing is to not stay in the drama of the problem and get into solution mode as fast as possible. You know, the only way to get through something, get to the end of something, is to go through it. And that's really true. So the faster that you can move through each process of whatever flyball is coming your way, you know, you got to catch that flyball with some surety if you can. And then you need to analyze how to get rid of that flyball. Where am I throwing this to next? What is the fastest way to get into solution mode? What's the objective? What are we trying to accomplish? Let's not lose sight of that. You know, let's go. Okay, we got this flyball. This is where we are. You know, and you're constantly having to reevaluate. You know, it sort of speaks a little bit to the Japanese concept of Kaizen. And it's interpreted in so many different ways, but the way that I most appreciated it, as it was relayed and taught to me through Jim Rohn, actually, who's a you know, personal development mentor who's well published, and you can audiobook him all day. And he just talks about, you know, sometimes you just need to aim and shoot and then refocus. Just get that action out there. See where, you know, it speaks to not spending too much time analyzing. Sometimes you got to shoot the arrow, see where it lands, and then refocus.
I love that so much. And I do feel like it's important to take action, because I feel like having that feeling of stagnation and being in that moment too long, it just paralyzes you even more.
It's crippling. It's crippling. It's akin, I think, to getting, you know, I mean, there are so many metaphors for it, you know, getting stuck in quicksand, or, you know, people say getting stuck in the quagmire, or I'm in a rut, you know, or whatever it is. The analogy is that somehow you're down in it and you're unable to find the force to get on up and get on out, or, you know, whatever it takes to move it forward, move the energy forward, you know.
Can you tell me about a time when that really made sense for you?
A million times. To find one time in all the millions of you know.
Because it is a practice, right? But yeah. I find that with most things that we learn in life, that there tends to be a sort of transition, and it may not happen very quickly, but there's a transition that happens from before you learn the lesson, and it helps move you through onto the next level. And so can you think of a time or a specific story where you really were able to make that connection? You were able to see, okay, this is the way that I've been doing things. This is what I can do about it. And then you decided to take action, because I feel like a lot of us hear good advice and we hear that this is what has worked for people, and we hear that this is what you should do or what you shouldn't do. But I feel like it really makes sense to us when we can really picture it and see it in a story.
I think that I'd have to just hark, you know, Talk about, there was a time where I felt I was just burnt. I had given every single ounce of humanity that I felt I could give in my job. And I, can, you know, there's a bunch of times in life where I felt like I should have said, you know what, this isn't working for my personal ecology for one reason or another, and there can be a number of valid reasons. And just the touch point on that is that there is no one magic reason why you leave. There can be a number, there can be one. You have to listen to your gut. And I decided moving on was a thing, but I needed to baseline. I needed a new baseline for my reality, for my happiness, for what made me happy. I needed to literally go sleep on a mat in a jungle with people who eat rice in the morning. And, you know, I felt the need to really baseline for myself, because I had spent so many years in the music business. And we're in a really interesting bubble, you know what I mean? And we work, those of us who tour travel in these bubbles that are created by the realities of show business, which in itself is an oxymoron, because we're in the smoke and mirrors business, but we're in a traveling bubble, you know, so it can, you've got to really have things outside of the bubble that ground you so that you don't. And one of the things that I ended up doing was going off and spending some time in Southeast Asia, in Thailand and Cambodia, and working with a charity that supports the ecosystem of elephants in Thailand, which they are revered by the queen, and they have a welfare program for them, and they bury them like warriors with helmets that the state pays for. And you get, if you're a mahout and you have an elephant that's been in your family, because what they did was they outlawed logging, and that put elephants and their handlers out of an economy. So they realized that they must somehow supplement some support if you're going to outlaw logging, because, you know, the elephants became integrated in Thailand with man because they were their warriors, like warrior horses. They rode them, they used them to build. And if you had an elephant, you treated it better than you treated your family pet. And this is still a concept that exists in Thailand, but because they outlawed logging, this is what led to people exploiting elephants on the street and elephant riding and things like that. So there's a movement, you know, elephants are revered there. So I went as part of a group to go and support a small village in Thailand I was cutting cane, honey, for the elephants and scooping poop of the elephants. And, you know, then I also got to walk with the elephants and go in a river with the elephants. But, you know, that kind of stuff, to be able to go and look at these folks and who were grateful to have us helping them out so that they didn't have to exploit their elephants, because the government gives them, like, they give them welfare, they give them food and they give them free medical care, you know. So this is a completely different belief system and value structure of a whole entire culture. And you have to, you know, sometimes you got to hit that reset in order to know which way you have to move next. You know, you've got to baseline it. And so that, for me, one of the biggest things that I did was not work for 6 months. I mean, that's the biggest. There are a million examples of times where I moved into solution mode on the fly. You know, we have canceled shows. We have trucks that don't show up. We have someone's got an injury. Someone's got food poisoning. You know, we're dealing with humans on the road. So humans, equipment, weather, flights don't fly, planes don't go. You know, I could give you 100 million examples of shit that comes out of left field and you can't even believe it, you know, and you just have to go, all right, we're going to fix this. You know, I had an artist. And just to get to the, you know, the end of that whole thing is that I came back from this experience and from Thailand onto Cambodia to work with teaching English in a school that the kids come in, and these are the kids that you read about whose families basically reside and excavate for their shelter, food and clothing in rubbish piles in third world countries. And this isn't an organization. It was called Feeding Dreams. And they bring these kids in to teach them English and writing and skills. It's secondary to the public school system. It acts as a way to teach them English, which is the universal language, but also gives them a meal, which they might not have, and also helps the parents because it's childcare. So it's a K-12 program. And that was, again, also being able to have a look at the realities that are well outside of our situation. When I came back, I decided that I wasn't going to really tour manage for a while. And I stopped responding specifically to tour management jobs and started to answer the phone calls of my friends who had positions on tour that I wanted to do because I wanted to go work with people that I loved and do jobs that were fulfilling in different ways other than necessarily the pay rate or the stature of saying I am the tour manager for XXX world-renowned pop sensation. Do you know what I mean?
Did you start to realize that the relationships and the journey that you were taking with the people that you cared about was really valuable, and that was maybe one of the good things about tour?
I tend to value relationships and put them pretty high on the list of resources that one has in their war chest or arsenal of personal skills, whether it's your professional life or your personal life. For me in this business, my relationships have been the reason that I have a career. Straight up, I owe it all to word of mouth and human beings. I do not have a business card. I haven't had one. I think in 2013, Jim Runge, and I probably have one around here, but I think my colleague Jim Runge, my good friend and colleague and co-host on TM101, we were working together and he made us get business cards. But that's the thing about relationships. The touring relationships are also not only, you know, they become, like I said, you're in a bubble, or sometimes it presents as an island and you're on the island with this gang. You know, you're in a tour bus. You're flying down the road in a moving thermos with 12 people for months at a time. And, you know, you're on a tour and maybe, you know, maybe it's one bus, two bus, three bus, four, five, six, 12, 11 buses full of people. You're out there. You know, everybody has to get fed every day. Everyone needs a place to shower. Everyone needs the creature comforts. And that's really the thing, you know, in addition to the show must go on, the way to keep a tour happy and healthy is to honor and understand that, you know, in addition, your objective not only of the day is not only to keep your artist happy and make sure that the show goes on, but you got, this is a human machine. And so you've got to have everything dialed in for your folks. And the more you honor that, and that might mean it, you know, it means honoring their needs and their creature comforts. It also might honor their need for space from one another, or, you know, a group outing, or you never know, you know, but that's part of the relationship and rapport building part of touring, because you're stuck together. And so you are really surviving. You're relying on each other you know, your people to have your back. And exhaustion is a part of touring because of the way we move and the hours that we keep. And we're, you know, quite often summoned to fit square pegs into round holes in record time, perfectly and with no interruption, you know. And then bring in 20,000 people to look at and then get them out and knock it down and take it somewhere else. So, you know, there's a lot of lofty objectives every day. And it's done under exhaustion sometimes and maybe shitty situations, you know, not too clean, food's not that great, tired, personal circumstances, environmental circumstances, you name it.
You as a tour manager, when you think about the way that you are taking care of the humans, right? And how important do you think it is to really think about how their mental state is and all that's, you know, how their well-being is physically and emotionally? Do you even have time to think about that? Is that something that the industry makes a priority? And how has it changed from, you know, did people ever think about it back, you know, like 10 years ago? Has it changed 20 years ago now?
The touring business as we know it, prior to March of 2020, the bar was set by legends who gave every drop of everyone's everything to do amazing shows in places where you couldn't even get trucks or buses or power. And at the time, it was, you know, there was just a lot more drugs, a lot less concern about self-care. You know, back at, where are we? So let's talk about 50 years ago. Do you know what I mean? 30 years ago. I could tell you that in the last 20 years, 10 years, the last few years, mostly, the mental health conversation, because what's happening is you have people dropping that are just, you know, it isn't a taboo discussion. You know what's happening. You know that Chris Cornell committed suicide. You know that Chester Bennington committed suicide. I can tell you that there are a slew of less famous and no less important people to our industry that have done the same. I mean, we are all victims of burnout. We are all victims of what we call tour drop, when you end a tour and you go home and you are looking for catering and don't know where you are and don't know how to communicate with what's going on in the real world. You end up with a set of coping skills that are unique to a certain section of people. And, you know, you share common experiences, and you end up somehow creating an ecosystem.
How so? And what is that? How is that ecosystem different from something that, you know, someone out in the everyday world would experience?
I think we have some unique, what makes the ecosystem forms in touring, because we are forced together in such close quarters for so many hours of the day for such a long time period. It's like if you put some plants in a terrarium, their roots are going to intertangle and they're going to intertwine. And then, you know, the roots are going to intertwine, and then the stalks are also going to intertwine. And the next thing you know, you can't tear them apart. So it's a similar, you know, if you use that kind of visual as to how the ecosystem creates, we're literally traveling in a bubble. There are literal security barriers to get to us. So it's not like, you know, there is literally every day a barrier to entry. So we literally live in a bubble. We travel in that bubble. We travel overnight under the cover of darkness. And our jobs are done behind the scenes. So we are ninjas. It's like a society of ninjas that are unknown to, unless you know us and personally, and you know what one of us does, you come to these shows as a patron or a fan, and you know that you're going to see these amazing light shows and these screens and that there's people on the stage, but it doesn't occur to you how they got there. We're sort of an unseen, and we're an entire unseen industry. So, you know, it's in a very funny way, it's like Fight Club. You know, what's you don't talk about Fight Club. You know, we're a whole entire little sort of subculture to an industry of folks that do things behind the scenes. And so that lends itself to a little bit of exclusivity. And we're all locked up with non-disclosure agreements. And you don't really, we pride ourselves, we bring our friends and family to work today, but only the ones you know aren't going to come into your very sterile environment, because you can't have every Tom, Dick, and Harry that you know come hang out at your gig. We have security issues because what we do is show business. It's celebrities, it's famous people, and there's a security risk involved. So, you know, because of the way that because of the nature of what we do, it isn't like I get up and I have my breakfast and I go work out and then I get in the shower and I hop in my car and I drive to the office and I do whatever the course of my day is and I get a meal or a break or something, or maybe I go for a walk and then I come back and maybe I hang out with my friends or family. I watch old TV, go to bed, my bed. And, you know, for me, I get up in the morning. I am, you know, look, assuming we're going into repeat venues and you know your steps and you've advanced and you know where you're going, but it's still disorienting. Where is the bus? Where am I parked? Where are we? What street are we on? You know, did I literally just open the door and now I'm in the street because we haven't parked the buses yet? It's like a whole different experience. You know, you don't have to ask your boss at your regular day job for grocery money. You're not looking for your boss at your regular day job to also be providing the correct pillows or make sure that your food doesn't have nuts in it because you have a food allergy, or that your donut feathers. And this is not the artist. This is the people on the tour. You got humans. You got to know who's got allergies. You've got to know who is, you know, needs to not have feather comforters and stuff in the rooms. You know, you have to get to know who may have family coming in and out. You got to get to know these things. And this is how the ecosystem, you know, comes to play, because you are living in a terrarium with people creating art.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So you have this ecosystem and you guys are all working on a creative project and you're going to see it come to fruition at the end of the day. What are some of the things that get lost in that every day, as far as the person goes, as far as the human being?
Couple of things. I'm reminded of one specific incident where I saw a creative director and a costume designer almost come to blows. And it was kind of a long time coming, I think. And I think that sometimes we lose the joy and the wonder and get so serious. A friend of mine has a t-shirt that says it's not rocket surgery. We are not curing cancer or doing anything that's life-saving. This is the entertainment business. Let's not be so serious. You know, let's understand, are the stakes sometimes very high? Of course they are. Is there a great deal of money going on in, you know, procuring and creating at times, depending on the level of tour that you're on? Of course there is. Is it serious business? Are we serious about this? We sure shit are. But that doesn't mean that it needs to turn you into, don't become a monster for the sake of the art, you know, especially if you're collaborating with a team. You know, you just, I think the challenge is to make sure that your team continues to feel jazzed about it. You know what I mean? That you, you know, look, and we have to be realistic that not, you know, sometimes we work for a client whose music may not be our particular cup of tea. But the overall product, if a good show is a good show, doesn't necessarily need to be your thing coming out of the speakers, but you can step into that moment and go, oh, that's dope. Oh, this is great. Oh, that was cool. Oh, look how cool that was. Oh, what a great moment that was, you know? And so you want to somehow make sure that you yourself, and if you can, the members of your team, don't take themselves too seriously, but also just, what are we doing it for? What are you creating art for? What are we making entertainment for? To torture ourselves? I don't think so. You know what I mean? We're doing it for the moments that we are able to connect people. You know, we are so connected when the show goes live, and so is everybody in the building. You know, the moment the lights go down, that's 90 minutes or so, give or take whatever your set length is, of course, that people are forgetting about, hopefully, what they're doing and singing the same tune and jamming on the same wavelength. And that's the brilliance. You know, we're the stewards of that magic. That's the magic.
I think that does get lost. You know, I've heard from people that I know, friends that I have that tour, and people get jaded. And I think that's with anything, you know, with any career that you choose. But really thinking about, like, why are you here? And realizing that we're all really in this life collecting moments. And how can we take the most precious parts of those moments and keep them and really, really understand what they are?
I still try to, I do walk out. I find a moment. Not every show, but damn close, no matter my position, to go catch some part of it, whether it might be, there might be in any show, one moment that I'm particularly connected to, or sometimes just to walk out there, see what's going on in front of house, and then take the slow walk back to the back of house and watch the fans lose their shit. I love that. It's why we go away from our homes and miss birthdays and milestones and sometimes sacrifice relationships and friendships, or, you know, people, you suffer when we go away. We go away. And is it awesome? Yes, it is awesome. And show days are my favorite days. But we go away, and we're away for a long time. And so we sacrifice quite a bit. So to go out there and see that fan that is just losing his mind and having, like, with such abandon, I just love that. To me, you know, that's what we're doing, why we're doing it, you know, mean it means everything to me.
I've had some people who have listened to the show, and they are people who are just trying to get into the industry. They're trying to understand how things work. And I'm, you know, you experienced that with TM101. And mm-hmm. I think behind any career choice.
Send them to us.
And I think behind any career choice, and really any choice in life, whether it's a relationship, whether it's where you're going to live, whether it's, you know, whether you're going to continue your education, whatever it is, you have to realize that behind it, there needs to be, like, a real mission behind it. And every day that you, as a tour manager, put on a show, or help put on a show, and stand out there and see how this is affecting, how this is bringing joy to people, that's really something that can help you continue doing what you're doing, even when things get really tough. And now more than ever, I think we can really see how when something, that ability to bring joy to people and that ability to do what you do best every day is ripped out from under you, you learn to really appreciate it and you learn to really see it for what it is. And so what are some ways that you have taken that and been able to turn it into something that helps you go through the hard times, like the ones that we're going through right now?
Ooh, that is such a loaded question, Janine. The thing that I always did about anything that my coping mechanism pre-March of 2020 was my work. What I do about anything, I'll work about it. And literally, I can tell you that in some of the heaviest, you know, situations or things that have happened in my life, the years that follow them were some of the most productive. They were like sprints in my career. Now, here we are. And the struggle for, and it's an interesting, you know, this COVID thing has been earth-shaking. I moved in the middle of the wind up to the lockdown and ended up in a new city with my suitcase that I came to Las Vegas with a residency for, you know, and I decided not to go back to South Florida because it was becoming a virus hotbed. It was Broward County was declared a state of emergency back in the first week of March. I was like, oh, you know, I had been out here looking for a place anyway. So I found myself moving to what I thought was going to be a hotbed of activity to a place that shut down. And literally that meant that everything that I thought was going to happen was not happening. And I ended up in my house. Also, there went my job. Oh my gosh. The industry that I've, you know, dedicated my heart and soul to for the last 31 years has just ground to a complete halt. Oh, it's the thing that I'm most passionate about in my entire life. Oh, okay. And with that went the other way that I heal myself, which is through live music. I cannot go and stand in front of a PA and get my hair blown back by some awesome, talented live musicians because no one's playing because we can't gather. What ended up being the thing that really was a grounding force was I was able, you know, I knew I needed to stay connected. And that I was concerned about how untethered folks in this industry who are normally tethered together, part of someone's crew, are now, you're on your own, kid. You know, so I tried to stay very connected. And that was also, you know, for me, it was important because I was in a new place and now everything was sort of falling apart and I'm in a new spot and I'm by myself. I'm in my house because I'm single, right? So as I'm trolling along, I think I'm on Bobnet and I see a post from a person called Mark Clark, who I did not know at the time, who says, hey, who wants to teach or learn about tour management? And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I know some things. And then I saw my friend Henry Bordeaux said, I'll do it. Now, Henry and I met under the umbrella of education and conversation about things like that, because we met at the, I believe it was called TourLink, conference at the time. And Henry was coordinating the panels and I was working with Henry on coordinating panels for a touring conference. So we already had experience. You know, our friendship was kind of formed on that. Right. So when Henry threw in, I was like, oh, wow, this isn't actually an opportunity to do some of the things that Henry and I maybe had tried to, you know, talk about or do. And then it just became, oh my God, Jim Runge. Oh my gosh. You know, he's one of my closest friends and a colleague that I've toured with for quite a bit of time. And he's so fantastic. And then, you know, here came Mary Jo, who I also knew for years and years and years. I knew about Mary Jo for longer than I've actually known her. And so we came together as friends under the conversation of doing women's panels So when she joined, we already, interestingly enough, had had a little bit of dialogue going about mentorship and education and things like that. And so then 5-1 joined us on a permanent basis. And so we got to know Doug and Mark, who were unknown to me altogether. And it was like, hey, let's do a thing where we're teaching people. We're like, okay. And, you know, as tour manager, we sort of, and this is a very long answer, very long detailed answer to, you know, what are the things that you do and you use to get through times, and especially right now, you know, it was like, let's maybe do some episodes. And as it happened, we sort of began to compartmentalize the chronological birth of a tour. And as we began to unpack, what's the first thing you do? You get hired. Then what do? You, who's your crew? And then what do? You gotta do the budget. And then what do? You know, you gotta get trucks and buses. So what are we gonna do? Let's get the truck and bus people. Come on, you know. And because everyone has been literally stopped in their tracks, A, everybody has time, but B, there's a willingness and a need to come. And, you know, in ancient civilizations and throughout history, people talk story to keep, you know, to educate and to keep a culture alive. And right now, while we aren't working, or well, while we're not moving, we're talking story. You know, we have a Thursday conversation with series on TM 101, where we're bringing in some of the legends and developers of concert business that we know, it guys who were on the original, you know, original brain trust of Lollapalooza and Coachella, and, you know, talking with folks from overseas and talking with heavy hitters and, you know, security and staging and trucking and busing, who've seen the arcs of this business. That's, I think, what has become currently the thing that I believe, once we're on the other side of this, whenever that seems to be, I say with all the trepidation, because it's the weirdest thing to not know what we're doing or what it, you know, to see the way that this business has suddenly unraveled and come to a screeching halt, and all of the fallout to our sub industries, you know, is really continues to be mind blowing to me.
And that really speaks to the point that you made earlier about taking action when you're feeling stuck.
It's interesting. One of the struggles that touring folk are faced with, we are the doers. We move a city from place to place every single day. When you present us with a problem, we are going to solve it. I'm going to just tell you what happened yesterday morning on the golf course. I was out golfing with two esteemed concert production gentlemen. I was driving the golf course, and four civilian folk were driving along on the path. And one of them, each in different, four guys in four different golf carts, because that's social distancing. One of them drove their golf cart over a curb, could not get it unstuck. These four gentlemen for 5 minutes labored and pushed and hit the gas, and the back wheels were spinning. And I'm like, it's not front wheel drive, it's a golf cart. I said, hang on, let me get my friends. Hey, you guys, can you come over and help these guys out? My two friends came off the golf cart. One of them jumped, got in my golf cart and backed it up. The other one put one hand and one foot in the beached golf cart, and within 18 seconds, road crew freed the golf cart. 18 seconds. I sat there and watched these men struggling, you know, and I just watched them for a while before I let the guys finish their shot before I called them, because this to me was like a comedy scene. And I knew it. I knew it. I'm like, oh my gosh, they can't. Hang on a second. Let me get my roadies. And they roadied that shit in 18 seconds. And so that speaks to what you just said about being stuck. And what's happening right now is the people that do things with the most efficiency, the quickest, the fastest, and like a ninja, you wouldn't even know was broken. We can't fix it. We can't outthink it. We can't solve it. We can't control it. All we can do is sit here and figure out how to not only make the best of it, but how to survive. I mean, at this point, we're talking about, you know, really, we have a physical threat that we can't see. And that because of the weird flow of or lack of information or the misinformation and the leadership or the lack of leadership and all of the ebb and flow of the way this is being handled right now and difference of opinions and the divide that we're facing as a country, we have physical danger that we can't really see because it's invisible. We are emotionally, we are twofold because A, you're on lockdown. That's isolation. You're either locked down by yourself or you're locked down with your family and they're driving you nuts. It's hard. And then there are those of us who have lost our entire livelihoods. And so many people have, but there are the industries that are in phase one, two, or three that don't require 10,000 people to show up to be able to do their jobs, that will go back to their ways of life. And because of the nature of our business and how many bodies we need in a room to make it happen, we've got a lot of questions. So, you know, we can't control it. So when you're stuck, you know, usually you want to immediately get into a solution and start fixing things, and we can't fix this particular predicament that we're in. So it's extremely frustrating for folks that I know who are unable to assert their normal expertise and war chest of skills to fix the problem. You can't call anybody right now. No number of contacts is fixing this. You know.
What you can do is, and this is what you're doing, and you know, Doug is doing and Henry's doing, you know, it's like take those abilities that you have and do something with them. And share them and let that be your plan of action and let it take you where it will, because at least you'll have a reason to get up and do that meeting, right?
100%. And you know, for me, becoming part of TM 101 had so many reasons for me to do it. First of all, the collaborative nature of what we're doing. You're never going to get seven tour managers that get to do a project together. I never get to work with my favorite people, you know, and there are some times in this business where you work with someone and you go, I hope I get to work with you again sometime, you know, because we're all moving in so many different directions. So that was really, really great. Also, I'm not good without a mission. Personally, that does not work for me. It is not good for my ecology to not have a team to contribute to or something to do. I can slip right into the abyss of this isolation. You know, I struggle with it when we have post-tour, postpartum, right? So this is, you know, a much bigger deal. So they give me a reason to show up and brush my hair and be able to string sentences and to communicate. I see them more than I see anybody. I didn't know Doug or Mark. I know them really well now, you know, we're all really good friends. And now we're to the point where when we get on for our planning calls, it's like family time for a minute, you know, it's really very sweet. And we also are very sure 40 or almost 40 episodes into this, 5 months into a public health crisis, a world pandemic, a worldwide industry shutdown, that we came together in a collaborative spirit, organically. One of our first episodes, somebody was in the chat and said, a good magician never shares their tricks. And I responded back and I said, we're past that. That we tried that. It didn't really work. First of all, that's not an effective, you know, we're not doing anything that is that, you know, we're working with spreadsheets and doing logistics. There's no big, you know, the Wizard of Oz, the guy behind the curtain. There's no big secret. You're going to pull the curtain back and we're just sitting here doing a job. First of all. Second of all, these young tour managers end up on our tours doing the openings, you know, support as support acts. Why would we want to handicap a legion of up and coming professionals by not sharing our information? It is not that special. Now, I will say that there are some proprietary methods and, you know, skill sets that we have, but for the most part, you know, this is an industry and we're not doing, being secret squirrel about how you do things. It doesn't help. It's not helpful. What helps is having, especially now, a healthy industry where people are collaborative, where you give the opportunity for people to continue to bring new talent into the pool of talent, to talk about diversifying, to have a look at the industry. You know, sometimes when you're in the middle of it, you can't see it. So we're all having a moment to take a 10,000 foot view of the music industry, particularly the concert touring industry, and lay the groundwork for potentially how it moves forward, to be able to claim some ownership in the health and well-being of our friends and colleagues and ourselves, so that when we come back, we've grown a bit. You know, we're hoping we are creating content that is impactful and that will mature well. You know, we're trying to keep it basic and simple so that it has a bit of a shelf life. And when we come back and, you know, revisit it years from now, because it's going to live on YouTube and YouTube was, you know, going to be outlive the cockroaches, you know, we're mindful of all of that, you know, and that's the labor of love about it, is that what it, we were trying to just do some stuff and share some knowledge. And now we've received enough input and we can see from the steady return of folks from as far away as Hungary and Russia and South, we, you know, our Brazilian and South American contingency and our, you know, UK gang. And we've come to know the presence of these folks, to receive their questions and to do some one-on-one mentoring with them, and to hear back from folks that are wanting to, you know, industry professionals that want to join us. And it's just becoming a situation where we've just been able to continue to breathe life into our community.
I love that so much. And I think everyone who is listening may, because of the importance that I think that we've discussed about caring about the human being, about caring about the industry, about connecting with people and reaching out for relationships and trying to help each other and share your knowledge. But I think a question that people may ask is, what can I do right now in order to help move the entire industry forward as an individual? What's one thing I can do?
I think there's a different levels of involvement in the industry might dictate what your footprint, how wide your ripple goes. You know, if you're new to the industry and you have yet to break in and you're wanting to do something in this business, definitely take the time to get your skill set together. Take an Excel class. You can never be too educated. Our younger set has communication skills and technology that they continue to, you know, bring to those of us who have been here for a minute and had beepers, you know, to get your communication and technology together and get your skills together, learn things about travel, learn things about logistics, stay plugged in and try to join organizations that are supporting the industry. For those of us who are professionals, we need to worry about our livelihoods and how we maintain. I encourage everyone to reach out to the resources, industry resources that are available to try and we've got to somehow figure out a way to take care of our folks. And everybody needs to just try to stay connected. And I also encourage seasoned professionals to broaden their skill bases as well. I think for the sake of your personal fulfillment, because when we've lost, a lot of us have lost the thing we love the most in this business, and that includes live music and the ability to do what we do, which we love. And you've got to be so passionate if you're going to be in touring. Find some of the other things that you loved. I mean, I look at Zito, our friend Zito, who's in Nashville, who his big pivot was he loved making cinnamon rolls so much. Now he's got a bakery and he's delivering and he's the cinnamon roll guy. So nurture your passion. Stay well through loving your friends and loving this community. Find the things that you maybe have neglected because we were too busy touring. And while you're on the hustle and you're looking for that pivot and you're fighting with unemployment and you're watching for a gig and you're trying to see what's next and you're trying to earn a living, just make sure that you take this downtime that we have before we get sucked back into the inertia of getting in a rocket ship, like, you know, slingshot, you know, before that happens. Nurture your personal passions a little bit. Take your photos, take your walks, get into your good self-care routines so that when we go back, you're in a better shape somehow, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and physically.
And that's really how you're going to have a better industry, right? If the people, if the humans within the industry are better.
I think we're trying to develop a more holistic way of approaching how we do this. Because you have to bleep out of your life and into this alternative reality, it serves us well to approach it from a holistic place and not just, you know, you're here to go to work and how you are living isn't important. It really is.
Thank you so much, Adrian. This was an amazing conversation. I could talk to you for hours and hours.
Anytime. It was a pleasure to come and share some experience with you. It was an honor to be invited, and anytime.
Here are some key takeaways from my conversation with Adrian Biondo. 1. Take action when you're feeling stuck. Aim, shoot, and then refocus. Spending too much time analyzing can often be paralyzing. 2. When you feel like you're burning out, it's okay to step back and aim to gain some perspective. Sometimes you have to hit the reset in order to know what move to make next. 3. The way to keep a tour happy and healthy is to understand that the whole tour is a human machine, so honor that. 4. Don't lose the joy and the wonder. You're in the entertainment industry. Yes, the stakes are high, but don't lose sight of why you got into it in the first place. So don't take yourself too seriously and enjoy the show. And 5. Nurture your passions. Stay well through loving your friends and your community, and make sure you take the downtime to improve your mental, emotional, spiritual, and physical self so that you're in a much better place when it's time to go back on the road. Thank you so much for joining us on the Tour Life podcast. Be sure to give Adrian a follow on Instagram at The Original Lioness, and don't forget to like, subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, and to follow The Tour Life on Instagram at The Tour Life Podcast.